My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm getting myself centered. I'm going to be full disclosure guy because I'm not the best at keeping on my calendaring straight on Zoom. So I put a shirt on in the last 5 minutes or so, a tie. I was sitting up watching binge watching Boardwalk Empire. And I was at one of the good spots, and my phone rings. I see Phil. He's like, "I'm getting nervous over here." I said, "Okay, what you telling me for? Getting nervous about what?" And he's like, "We're waiting on you." I'm like, "Waiting on me?" Anyway, nobody's interested in that but me. And the benefit of these Zoom meetings is that I can get a call, have totally dropped the ball on where I'm supposed to be, and still show up where I'm supposed to be. Wow. I don't know what we're going to get, but, you know, I've been, since we've been in this new deal that we're in right now, meeting, not face to face, but meeting eyeball to eyeball anyway, meeting internationally, globally, any time of the day or night. It's led to a lot of, I guess, introspection on my part, because I get to go out and talk a lot anyway. And but since we've entered this deal, I've had the opportunity to listen to a lot of you guys and a lot of my friends that I don't get to see all the time. And for me, I have been reinvigorated. I know for a lot of people, getting accustomed to not hugging and not seeing each other. And I mean, it's been a little unsettling. It was unsettling for me at first. It took me a while. People had to, you know, literally stalk me like Phil was talking about. In the first couple of weeks of March, all the way up into early April, I'm not trying to get on here. I don't know what it's going to be like to sit down and talk to your computer. Man, miss me with that. But I'm a third step guy in all my affairs. And once I got on this and got accustomed to it, now I see nothing but benefit. And why not see anything but benefit is what we have. We haven't opened up out here totally. I'm in Los Angeles, California, by the way. And some meetings have opened. I haven't gone to any. I live with my 90-year-old mom lives with me. And so we really take shelter in place really serious. But I've seen, and I don't know a reason not to embrace. I'm a guy, and I have a lot of friends that have had problems with what we're doing and have worries about what is AA going to look like when we come from outside, out of this, when we open up again. What is AA going to look like? Will we be negatively impacted by the fact so many people have now become reliant on Zoom meetings? Will we be that's in the future. We have what we have right now, and B, I don't have a contradiction in missing. I miss face-to-face meetings, but I still love the Zoom format. And that's not an inconsistency for me. I see all the benefits. And when I go back and when I get to hug and when I get to do all that, I will really re-embrace that. But I don't think I'll ever leave you guys because I love the idea of a time of traveling all over the world from my living room. And I'm a guy that doesn't have any problems with the fact that I'm not always supremely inconvenienced because I'm inconvenienced enough as it is. But, you know, I should take that back. Because if you come from where I come from, the things that you guys ask me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess at best, you know, at their very worst, I consider inconvenient because the life that you've given me, Dr. Bob says, you know, taking out an insurance policy every time he goes and he talks about repaying a debt. Taking a minute to ease into what it is that we're doing. because really, to be honest with you guys, I don't know where we're going. You know, back in, I guess probably about 1929, 1930, early 30s at the latest, there was a guy, Roland Hazard, that had a drinking problem. Roland Hazard was a businessman, and Roland Hazard was a guy that had money, had access to money, came from a family with money, and he had a drinking problem. And Roland Hazard, unlike me, did what it is that you do when you got money with a drinking problem. He threw money at it. And his family sent him across the ocean, and he went and consulted with the preeminent shrink of the day, Dr. Carl Jung. Fortunately, he saw Jung, and he didn't see Jung's mentor, Freud, or we probably wouldn't be here. That's a sidebar story. But he saw Carl Jung, and he consulted with Jung for about a year. And so when Jung got through with him, you know, he did what it is that you do when you throw money. And he had all these sessions, and he got shrunk really good, and, you know, probably got in touch with his inner child and all the stuff that you do when you're in therapy. I've never been, but, you know, I've seen movies. And so when he left Jung, he said, I know I'm straight. I know I'm good. I spent all this money. This is a premier dude. This is not a quack. This is not a sidewalk guy. This is a well-known, world-renowned, preeminent in his field guy, right? And so he leaves Dr. Carl Jung convinced he's not going to be drinking. And before he could get off the boat coming back, he was drunk. He was drunk. He did what it is I would do in that situation. After I spent good money with somebody, he went back to him. Check this out, Doc. You got to talk to me. I spent all my money with you. I was convinced that you were the man. Talk to me. What happened? Dr. Jung said, check this out, Roland. I tripped. I misdiagnosed your case. You present like a lot of other cases present. You look like schizophrenic. You look like manic depressive. You look like bipolar. We present like a lot of other stuff. You know, in active alcoholism, we look like we resemble a lot of other mental people, and a lot of us have visited mental institutions, you know. And Jung told him, dude, I tripped. I misdiagnosed you. What you are is a chronic alcoholic. And I have never been successful with any case with the methods I've employed with an alcoholic of your type. Chronic alcoholic, the mind of a chronic alcoholic. Chronic diseases as opposed to acute diseases. Acute diseases, measles, mumps, chicken pox, get it, get over it, you don't get it again. Chronic disease, heart disease, diabetes, alcoholism, got it, you got it. That's it. And he said, you had a mind of a chronic alcoholic. And, you know, I ain't been successful with a case like yours, not me. Roland Hazard says, oh my God, doctor, talk to me. Is it any hope for me? What is it that you're trying to tell me? Because the doctor is like, man, you, I don't know what to tell you. You doomed. Wait a minute. I came to the top, dude. You can't help me. Doc says, well, every now and then, here and there, I haven't witnessed this myself, but I've heard about cases such as yours, and they've been, you know, they've been what I call in the nature of vital spiritual experiences. I've heard of people who've had that, and they've recovered from this deal that you suffer from. I've heard about them. I don't know how to give it to you. I know what you need, this vital spiritual experience, but I don't know how to give it to you. I don't know what to tell you. Roland, you know, every now and then, here and there, what we would typically call a miracle, something that happens very, very, very rarely, you know, very rare occurrences, don't know how they come about either, you know. So he says, what I would suggest, Roland says, well, these vital religious spiritual experiences, how do you get one? He says, well, I would suggest, because Roland kind of got hardened at that time, I go to church. Doctor said, well, Roland, I'm sorry to tell you, if you going to church would have been the answer, you never would have had to come see me. But all I got to suggest to you, dude, is wherever you go, when you go back home, you know, if you got any religious leanings, if you know any people you want to, you know, that you want to go to, temple, mosque, church, synagogue, someplace, but go, I would suggest you go there, find some religious group and hope you get struck by lightning. Roland Hazard left Dr. Carl Jung, returned to the Oxford group of his day, and he got struck by lightning. Something happened to Roland Hazard at the Oxford group. And while he was at the Oxford group, in the midst of this happening, a friend of his, Abby Thatcher, ended up in court on a case. The Oxford group members, one of their calls to action was to minister to folk. And so Roland and a couple of his boys heard about Abby Thatcher's plight. Abby ended up in court in front of one of Roland Hazard's partners' dad, who was the judge. And so Roland Hazard showed up at court, a couple of other guys, you know. And so he shows up at court and he convinces the judge, you know, to release Abby Thatcher into his care, into him and his buddy's care, you know. So Roland leaves with Sabra, and they leave the court, take Abby back to the Oxford group. Abby's with the Oxford group. Most of us know where this story ends up. About 60 to 90 days into Abby's stint in the Oxford group, it was time for him to go out and do what they call, you know, he had to go and do give testimony to somebody. Only somebody he could think of was an old friend of his named Bill Wilson. And he called on Bill Wilson in November of 1934. And we like to talk about a lot of seminal moments in Alcoholics Anonymous, some things that if they wouldn't have happened, we wouldn't be here. Many of us talk about this being a spiritually divinely inspired program. And if you're new sitting on here, you might hear that a lot and you might wonder, what the hell are they talking about? And what we talk about is not so much that when the big book was written, harps were playing and angels were singing and people were sitting, you know, in angelic poses. No, drunks were writing. Bill Wilson primarily did the writing. But most of us talk about the ties that hold us together, the thin ties that hold us together, and some of the things that had to conspire to bring us together so we sit together in a Zoom meeting in 2020. And one of the first threads was those threads stretching from Carl Jung to Roland Hazard, to Abby Thatcher, to Bill Wilson. And somehow through that process, we end up from this every now and then hearing their experience of this vital spiritual experience the Jung talked about. So that every now and then miracle to what Bill described in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, as the kind of wholesale miracles that we see all the time. And I want to talk about that because I believe in miracles. And we talk about a process by which the replication of the spiritual experience, mass production, and you don't, we can't create this thing that we have, you know, because all of us have something in common. All of us have a few things in common. All of us have a how dark it is before the dawn day. All of us have that in common. All of us have that are sitting on here. We may have some non-alcoholic members on here, but all of us who suffer from this thing that I have, we have a couple of things in common. We have an allergy of the body that we're never going to be free of. You know, we have this compulsion to keep going back to what's killing us, no matter the fact that we see that it's killing us. We have a brain that's stuck on, we call that a mental obsession, you know. But all of us who sitting in these squares today, we have something else. We have a date that precedes whatever it is that you the first went in the recovery, active recovery. October the 10th of 1986, I couldn't put it down. And my life hadn't started like that. And on October the 11th of 1986, something entered my life and I haven't picked it up. And that's something that entered my life on October the 11th wasn't the 12 steps. It wasn't the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't a sponsor and it wasn't me. What happened to me on October 11th of 1986 that all of us have in common what happened to me is grace came calling. God's grace. And all of us had that grace come calling moment. And I think for the rest of my 33 plus years walking this journey with you guys, I've been walking under the grace, the umbrella of grace. You know, and the nature of the grace of October the 11th of 86 was a very limited. When opportunity meets desperation, a small window of grace opens up. And I jumped through the window on October the 11th of 1986. But there's an expiration on that grace born of desperation. There's an expiration date on that. You know, desperation is a really small part of the fuel that's in my propellant right now, you know, 33 plus years later. At that time, it was all I had. But there's an expiration date on that. And so this matter of grace, this deal that we don't control, we can't predict, we don't create it, but each and every one of us have certainly tasted it. You know, that's what it's been about. That's the whole deal. That's the whole deal. My sponsor, who's Bob B. out of St. Paul, Minnesota. My sponsor likes to say, if you're reading a book and if you're practicing these principles, taking these steps for anything other than relationship with the power, then you're doing it as a management tool. And that's human power. So having information is cool, you guys. Reading a book to learn the page numbers and the quote and to look impressive when I come to it, that's cool too, you know. But for new people on this platform, information is cool, and that attracts me somewhat. But what holds me and binds me and really charges me in Alcoholics Anonymous is not the information, it's the transformation. Transformation. And that's why we tell our stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the best way to see transformation is I got to see the before so I can now appreciate the after. So we tell before and after stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they all look different. And there are as many different portraits of the alcoholic as there are alcoholics. And that's why we tell our stories. It's not to impress you. It's not for the world. I like them. You know, I like impressive stories. I like our stories, but that's why we tell them. I love that format. I'm a guy that still loves going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of Zoom, as I started out, I've been reinvigorated because now, dude, when I first came, and I'm going to go all over the place today. I can already see it now. It's a couple of categories of speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's probably more than a couple of categories. One category I like to call the head speaker. And those speakers really inform us, you know, they give us really good and I like talking about that, especially in a workshop or something, you know, really give us good instructions on how this deal works. And they're informative. And I'm a head guy, so I kind of like that, figure stuff out. The only problem is with sometimes with the head speaker, every now and then it kind of feels like finger in your face. And I'm the guy, get your finger out of my face, stop. You know, I'm not that guy. Then you get the second kind of speaker. And that kind of speaker, at my first home group, 9604 South Figueroa, we had a brother named Brother. And Brother used to say, when heart speaks, heart hears. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we speak the language of the heart. And, you know, and it has been my mission. It's what it is I do. That's why I don't know what we're going to get. I don't know what it is we're going to get, because I'm not here as an authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not even here and I'm not an authority on the Big Book or the Steps. You know, I don't label myself as a Big Book guy, a Big Book guy. I'm a guy. I'm a drunk who stumbled into a place. Like I told you some summers ago now, and I've walked into a lot. You know, it's interesting to me. Let me just give you the real quick Reader's Digest, you know, profile. Grew up in South Central Los Angeles. You know, I grew up in Watts in the 60s. welfare mom, five brothers, raising six boys by herself. Had an old man who's an alcoholic. He got put out when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And so now I got this mom that's raising these six boys, welfare mom in the 60s, you know. And I've been reflecting because I talk a lot. And so I got married to a narrative, you know, and that narrative really was not all that accurate. My brother Ron talks a lot too. And I started hearing some of what Ronnie was saying. And I'm like, that doesn't always jive with what I remember. And when you do a lot of talking in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we don't get to expand and share our whole life. So we give you the shortcut version. And sometimes I get stuck on what I think my memory was. And some things have started getting a lot clearer to me, you know, because I was a square kid and I was a shy guy, but, you know, I was a good kid. You know, a lot of us talk about before taking the drink, I had the ism, and I don't know really what that means. You know, if you're new, sometimes you can get stuck in thinking that when we share our stories, a lot of people will make it sound like circumstance and situation is a description of alcoholism. That's a circumstance and situation. The fact that I grew up with a single mom raising six boys, that's not that is by no means a definition of alcoholic. The fact that my daddy was an alcoholic, by no means is that the reason I'm alcoholic. The fact that we didn't have no money, by no means is that the reason that I'm an alcoholic. The fact that the first car in my family was the car I bought when I graduated from high school. You know, somebody in here grew up with a silver spoon. Somebody in here grew up with parents that never took a drink. Somebody in here grew up with both parents. Somebody in here, I grew up in Watts, you know, a hard, hard town. Somebody in here probably grew up in whatever is the most affluent part of whatever city you in. I don't know where we are right now. I was getting ready to say grew up in Beverly Hills or Palos Verdes, but I think you guys are probably back east, you know, but whatever it is, you know, and so the fact that, that sometimes you'll hear a lot of our stories, feeling abandoned, feeling less than, feeling inferior, feeling there are lots of us who suffer from abuse as kids. Many of us, like me, have this idea of, you know, I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. So I've always been, but all those are just certain, plenty of people feel like that, man. You know, one thing that's interesting that is a requirement for alcoholism, drinking alcohol. And that's one of the bedrock requirements for it. So I hear a lot of people say, I think I was alcoholic before I took a drink. I don't know about that. I don't have an opinion on it. But what for me happened to me is, you know, as I go back through my life, you know, I was a happy-go-lucky little kid, man. I had some stuff going on. We didn't have money, but if everybody around you don't have money, you don't know it. You know, I played ball in the street. I had fun with my brothers. I waited at the bus stop for my mama because my mom, you know, was a single mom on welfare. She ended up working two jobs. She was a domestic. After she got off work, she'd go clean people's houses. She'd come home late at night. I was the kid that would sit at the bus stop and wait on my mom to come home. I'd walk her home, and at a certain period, I can remember she stopped taking the bus home, and I stopped waiting on her because when she got off work, she'd go to night school, and she got a high school diploma at night. Then she went to community college at night. Then she went to college at night. Then she graduated from college and went on to a distinguished career in the insurance field, retired with a lot of accolades, big retirement, all this kind of stuff. So my mom is a very inspiring lady, a very big force in my life, you know. And so I grew up like that with dreams, goals, hopes, and ambitions. Being a kid in the 60s, man, it was a hopeful time. It was a crazy, turbulent time. But if you grew up in Watts, man, and you were a young brother in Watts, man, I was going to be somebody, and I was going to make a difference in my neighborhood, in my community, in my state, and in this country. I thought I'd be in politics, and I thought I'd be a leading figure. I always thought I'd be a person who left footprints, but at the same time, I still always had this idea of being inconsequential. I heard a speaker one time say, if you treat me special, I feel normal. If you treat me normal, I feel rejected. That's me. That's me in a nutshell. You know, always, you know, in the top part, you know, they used to divide the class. We'd have one classroom. So you didn't have AP classes at that time, in other, but you had the top percent, you know, you had group A, group one, group two, and group three. I'm always in group one. I'm always president. So I'm that kid, man. And I'm popular. you know, but I'm shy and I'm square and I'm growing up like that. So I don't start drinking till high school, took my first drink, didn't drink in high school for real. Started drinking in college, went off to UCLA, started drinking, smoking weed, doing other drugs, doing what you do in the 60s, man, having a good time, having a popular time, running with a fast crowd, running with a fast crew, running with people who were going to leave their mark in the world, and I'm going to be one of them. But I got that thing, and you can't tell it. It doesn't show up. My people that I was running with look just like me. I'm glad in chapter 3, you know, the Bill talked about classifications of, and he talked about the heavy drinker, and the heavy drinker looks just like me. That was important for me to know because I thought that I was in a phase, you know, and I thought I'd come out of this phase just like all my college guys did. When we came out of school, they started getting married, started raising families, started businesses, started working, and they came out of it. They stopped. I'm still in it, you know, and by about 1978-79, I started realizing this is not a phase that I'm going through, that something's got its grips on me, you know, and up into the 80s, you know, got married, you know, had a little girl. She's 2.5 years old by the time I made it to you guys. And a lot of things happened after I got married in 1980 to the time I got put out the house in 1985. You know, Bill in his story talked about lots of unhappy scenes in his sumptuous apartment and the unhappy scenes in my crib, man. Walking in the door. These are things that happen. These are just the high point things I remember walking in before. And this happened more than once. Guy in the house, you know, wife and daughter crying. Dude in the house with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. One night sitting on my back porch, daughter coming outside, pulling in my coat, daddy, that's my piggy bank. Saved up for our first house. $10,000 in the bank. My wife made the mistake one night. We had it in a separate account. ATMs had just come out. We used to call them versatellers. And my wife made the tragic blunder of giving me the ATM card one night to go get some food, maybe some milk or something. Our daughter was an infant. And when you hit the account, it's $10,000. And then it's like at $9,700, you don't trip. Then it gets to 8,200. Then it gets down to 5,400. And one day, inside of a month, you look up and it's $80. It's $80. To this day, I don't know how I'm still here to be talking to you guys, because that was the longest morning of my life, the morning my wife confronted me about what happened to the bank account. So I had lots of stuff like that, man. But what I really had, I got put out the house because I was going to my wife's purse on a regular basis. So I got put out of my house and I went to stay at my mom's house. And my 5 brothers ended up back there too. All of us suffer from this disease. All of us were drinking and using together. 4 of us suffer from this disease in the same way that I do. And 4 of us made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But in 1985, all 6 of us were at my mom's house. We had all got put out of our respective homes, and we almost killed my mom. So when I came to you, October 1986, I was 33 years old, and I was a broken young man. No more dreams, no more goals, no more ambitions, no more hopes, no more Christmases, no more birthdays. No more parent-teacher conferences. No more going to see grandma. No more going to see my dad when he came to town to see my grandmother. No more Thanksgiving dinners with everybody around the table. I became a foot soldier. Never homeless because I got a mom that didn't give up on her boys. And I suspect that the reason she didn't is because me, Ronnie, and Reggie had given her such hope, you know, and she had been so accustomed to sticking her chest out about us. First 3 kids off our block to go to college. My younger brother, Ron, graduated from law school early. So my mom was so accustomed to praise in her sons and back in her sons, that it took a minute for us to lose the currency we have built up. And I'm so grateful because she stayed in and she had enough God. She had enough God. So we started coming to you in 1986. I came to you October the 11th of 1980. My brother Ron had 3 months when I came. We went through the same treatment facility. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started hearing the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, man. You know, there are some things that for me still resonate with me to this day. You know, I love going to meetings. And as I said a couple of times in restarting this, I've been revived on Zoom. I get to hear from different people and I get to hear in different places and I get to travel and I get to see my fellowship. I get to see, I'm blessed already. You know, I think that I am more blessed than most in our fellowship because I already get to travel all over the world and I get to see Alcoholics Anonymous in ways that most people don't get to see Alcoholics Anonymous. But now everybody gets to see that we're part of something that's way bigger than just me, than just my home group, than just my area, than just my state. I'm part of a worldwide fellowship. If you're sitting here and if you're new, and if you feel like life is over for you, and if you feel like you don't know if you'll ever be welcome in anybody's house again, and if you feel like it just seemed like the hole is just too deep, why even try? I remember one of the reasons I kept going to meetings, because there would be times, man, when I was out there and I'd want to muster it up. I'd want to muster it up. And I'm self-willing, you know, but I never wanted to give up drinking and using entirely. I wanted to give up having the consequences. I wanted to give up missing birthdays. I wanted to give up not having Christmas presents. I wanted to give up making my mama cry. I wanted to give up seeing that look of disgust in my wife's face. I wanted to give up coming out the motel at 12 noon with the birds singing and I want to shoot them out the sky. I wanted to give up that stuff real bad. And sometimes if I'm broke, it was easy. And I'm mustering it. And then there'd be a period at which I'm going to do it anyway. So why am I playing with myself? Why am I playing with myself? The inevitability, we don't even think about it like that. But it's, if I know I'm going to do it, why even play with myself? One of the things that happens, this is a side benefit of going the means of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I think the inevitability gets chipped away. I start seeing some people that's doing this for 30 days, 90 days, and it dawns on me, I'm not inevitably going to do that. You mean there is a way up and a way? You mean this doesn't have to just be, and there are some things that we get, man, that we don't realize. I'm not a person, I'm a three legacy guy, and you never hear me diminish one part of our program to have to emphasize another part. I know it's fashionable, all you thumpers that's on here right now. I know it's fashionable to bash, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. That ain't a MET program of recovery. No, that's not a program of recovery. But check this out. If you can't transmit something you haven't got, right? We know that. Can't transmit something you haven't got. I hear somebody saying 90 meetings, and then I'll get with my people because we, you know, we book people and we'd be like, man, what kind of message is that? Now, one breath I'm saying he's an untreated alcoholic. He haven't taken a step yet, but I want him to be able to transmit a message as if he had. Maybe the only message some folk have is 90 meetings. If that's all you got, say it. And then deliver them for 90 days to the people that's going to tell them what to do while they're coming for the 90 days. Quit tripping. Okay, off my soapbox. Let me get off my soapbox. You know, but there is nothing wasted. in God's universe. There's nothing wasted. Stop tripping off the way people are talking. Stop tripping off the way people are saying. Just get on with it. You know, I used to be that guy. When you get on fire for the book at first, man, you be coming to the meeting. You just discovered the book. You be on fire for the book. And now here you are, probably like me. I got on fire 18 months sober, right? Because I started a big book workshop at my mom's house. Me, my brother Ron, and my boy Strange. We saw some people bring the book alive in a way we had never seen at a meeting. We asked a couple of them, would you do it for us? And in November of 1987, we sat around my mother's dining room table. I was still staying at my mom's house. I was not even a year and a half sober. And we started going through that brew book, you know, page by page, line by line. And we had what we are guaranteed to get as a result of these steps. We had a spiritual experience, you know. I had an awakened spirit, you know, and we liked it so much that we did it again. And we've been doing it ever since 1987. Now we're doing it on Zoom, you know, and on Sunday mornings on Zoom. We just started our latest session 3 weeks ago. And on Sunday morning on Zoom now, we have 500 people, that's our limit, that want to go through the book. I never would have thought when I came in broken in 1986 that I would have the opportunity to get to interact with so many men and women in this life-saving thing that we do. You know, but I was new when I first got introduced to the book, man. I'm on fire, of course, and I'm rolling the meetings. And people, old-timers probably just be nodding, oh, yeah, this one, he just now caught the fire. Because I'm coming in and I'm giving you all everything I got. I'm telling you about Silkworth, and I'm giving you some history shots, and I'm talking about Bill around the dining room table with Abby. And, you know, man, I'm also on the other hand too, I'm listening to the old cats and they ain't breaking it down like that, or they not doing it right. Now they've been here 30 years. Dude, he don't know what he's talking about. You know, here he is. He don't even know the allergy from the obsession. He don't know. I'm nitpicking. I'm tripping. That ain't step 10. That's step 11. You know, what is he saying? Recovered or recovering? He don't ain't even getting it. I'm tripping. You know, I'm nitpicking on it, you know, and I'm tripping and I'm not seeing the beauty and I'm not seeing God's handiwork. And I'm sitting there, but I'm going through the phases, man. You know, I'm one of the people talking about it ain't the quality, it's the quality. And there's truth in that, but youth is wasted on the young man. When you're young, of course, that's what you say, because that's all you got. You don't know nothing about experience yet. Let me speak for myself. I don't know nothing about experience. So I'm running around talking about God is everything or he's nothing. And I'm quoting it and I'm breaking it down. Yeah, God is everything. But I ain't had a God is everything moment. I've had some God is everything moments, man, since I've been here. And you guys have walked me through them. I've had three major valleys in recovery, you know. I've had some remarkable things happen to me in my recovery. You know, one of the remarkable things that happened that I never get to talk about, you know, my dad left and I was on about my third inventory. Column one, my dad, column two, he left us. And I was on about my third inventory when I realized I was lying about that narrative because he didn't leave us. He got put out. My mama put him out. Cold thing about it is, and I knew that, but when it would show up as resentment, it always showed up as he left us. So I'm talking to a friend about 3 years ago, because I hadn't seen my dad since 1998. And we're not close. We weren't close. And me and my brothers thought he looked good going. We got a stepdad that came in our life, a remarkable man, remarkable. He came into my mom's life when she had six sons. And this guy came in because my mom just had it like that with him. So God looked out for us in that way. This man gave us what my old man couldn't. He was a professional guy and he was the rest. And my old man was a janitor. You know, so my old man, I'm talking to somebody a couple of years ago. And we talking, and I don't know how the conversation came up. Maybe they had lost their parent or something. And I said, you know what? I think when I get the news that my dad has passed, it'll probably feel like a person I kind of knew somewhat. I think it'll, and the person, and then they, and he was like, sound like you got a resentment. I said, no, I ain't got no resentment. But here's the deal, man, about what you guys have done to me from being with you all these many years. You've tilled my soil, and I'm always open for stuff. So it must have went in there somewhere. And I started thinking about it. And on Christmas Eve 3 years ago, I called my dad up. And I didn't have a resentment, you guys, but I had something else that I didn't know about. Because I called him, I said, you don't know who this is. He said, who is it? I said, it's your namesake, because my dad's name is Ralph White. And he started crying. And I started crying because I didn't have a resentment, but I had something I didn't know I had. I didn't know I had this big reservoir of love for my dad. And he told me a story. He told me about getting put out with his six boys. He told me about sleeping in a car for a year because he was too embarrassed to tell his own parents, my grandparents, because they took him in, that he had failed. He told me about going and working as a migrant worker for a couple of years after that, catching tuberculosis and almost dying. He told me he used to cry himself to sleep wondering what his sons were doing. Found out his story. So I've been talking to him regularly, made amends to him. He told me he hadn't had a drink in a year since his wife had died. Medical reasons. He didn't come to us. Medical reasons. On a walker. Said, but I haven't had a drop of liquor. I told him I hadn't had one in 30 years at that time. Told him about my other brothers. Told him he had grandkids. Told me how sorry he was he hadn't been a dad. I told him how sorry I was I hadn't been a son. Hadn't checked on him when his wife died. Hadn't stayed in touch with him. Sorry that I had withheld your grandkids from you all these years. And sorry I withheld myself from you. And if it's anything I can do going forward, to the best of my ability, I'm going to be your son. He's 91 and he's got colon cancer now. Talk to him Sunday on the phone. I'm glad that Grace found me that October in 1986. As a result of that grace, that same grace all you guys experience. Something happens for us. I know my time is up, but something happens for people like us. We're not the only ones who get the benefit of that grace. Something happens. See, I got two grandsons, this biological. And just like my granddad was to me, I'm the guy. I'm granddad. I inherited four grandkids when my daughter got married to her husband. Just sent my oldest grandson off to Tennessee State, freshman. I've stood at graduations for both my daughters, high school, college, one of them from law school. I've walked down the aisle and I've given a girl away. Stood in delivery rooms, my daughter, two of my grands. I've been at parent-teacher conferences. These are all the things, if you knew, that you got to look forward to. Maybe not the big deals. Maybe not the... They say, you know, if you hear, it's a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. And I thought that would have to be the spectacular. But a life beyond my wildest drunken dreams, I just described it to you, man. I've been up on a curb, shaking, with a car about 6 inches from a light pole. And I was thanking God, because this is what dads do. They get their daughters their first driving lessons. I've been overpaid. I told you my 90-year-old mom is here with me. I got an assignment that I didn't know I was being groomed for when I came to you guys back in 86. I didn't know we'd have a pandemic in 2020. But as a result of the rooms, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the power you guys gave to me, he's empowered me to be here. It's me and Mom. And I'm so grateful. You know, You know, Phil called me and I was like, what am I going to say? He got me at the last minute, you know, and as usual, you know, if God had brought you from where he brought me, you talk about him all night long too. I always wanted to do something important and significant. And I can think of nothing more important or significant than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll never hear Ralph White say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.
Thank you, Ralph. Absolutely awesome. Yeah. And, you know, for some of you that were here a couple weeks ago and watched our little our welcome home extravaganza, this gentleman here was here with us all day for that. So he's on fire for this. He enjoys watching everybody talk, you know, all the other guys that we had. He's just on fire. Every time I go on a Zoom meeting and see, he's on there. So he lives for this. And thank you so much, Ralph, and you nailed it, man. You know, that's God. We're going to open the chat room, and if you want this recording, we have it recorded, and I'm going to actually stop the recording right now. And